You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for April 11th, 2014. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside Chris Christie's restraining order, it's The Professional Left with Drift Glass and Blue Gal. Yeah, our toes are right on the line of the restraint.
Right on the line.
Yeah.
And he's restrained against coming within a certain distance of me, for sure.
Of my script, of my notes.
My notes.
Yeah, he can't touch my podcast
notes. Can't touch those podcast notes, Lord.
Yeah.
This is what I have been saying all along, though, a year ago.
That this poor innocent man has been tormented by the liberal press to the point where he's snapping? Is that what you've been saying, Blue Gal? Because
no.
That's clearly what's happening.
No.
By the way, I'm trying out for Stephen Colbert's job, so I'll be an obnoxious jerk for the next hour or so.
We'll get to that in just a sec. I just want to say, yeah. Chris Christie is a bully. He is absolutely lacking in the temperament to be a national candidate for anything.
Oh, so, yeah.
End of story. But congratulations, Stephen Colbert. He's going to take over The Late Show. From the retiring David Letterman.
He will be missed.
I'm assuming that he must have read the newsletter that I got from the Ladders this week.
Ha! Ha!
5 reasons to quit your job.
I want to hear all 5 of those reasons. Because if I ever have a job, I'll be looking.
You'll know whether to quit or not.
Oh, number 7, number 4, number 2.
Well, here's the part that got me. Uh-huh. It's always easier to land a job when you have a job. So before you hand in your notice, secure a new job first.
Yeah.
Thanks to mobile technology, it's easier than ever to search for a job anytime and anywhere.
It is.
Download our free mobile app and turn your commuting time and lunch hour into valuable job search time.
Yeah. I don't get Wi-Fi under the bridge where I live.
Exactly.
So that's a bit of a problem.
I sold my smartphone to pay for dental work.
Yeah. Sorry. And could I put in one quick plug for my own blog?
Sure.
This is not a fundraiser. That will come later, I promise. But I learned today that there is an Ayn Rand-inspired science fiction musical that's being mounted in the great city of New York. And you can go look up the post at my site. It's called Hello Dollar.
Hello Dollar.
in the post I said, if writing bad science fiction is shooting yourself in the foot, then turning bad science fiction, which is what Anthem is.
Into a musical?
On purpose is like taking another bullet and pounding it by hand through your foot with a hammer.
Uh-huh.
It's just, oh my gee. But, you know.
Maybe it's the producers all over again. You know, it's springtime for Hitler. And it'll be a surprise hit.
I would appreciate anybody who wants to drop by and give me your best parody names for an Ayn Rand musical. The funniest of which, the ones that crack me up, I will put on my front page. This is not a contest. There's nothing you can win.
I'm already working on a Photoshop. My Unfair Lady.
Yes.
Which is one that one of your commenters already came up with.
And I've got the Lion King already.
The Lion, L-Y-I-N.
And the Wealth Producers. But the commenters are very funny. And if it's a great way to burn 5 minutes of your time. There's nothing to win. You'll never get famous. You ain't going to get rich, but it's kind of fun. And if you'd like to try to make a contribution to that long and growing list of parody names, drop on by driftglass.blogspot.com and drop it in the comment section.
I'm already working on the libretta.
Huh?
Poor Professor Krugman. Just you wait, Henry Paulson. Just you wait. And who can forget?
Uh-huh.
The reign of Bane stays mainly as capital gain.
The Caymans.
In the Caymans.
My wife is very clever. So feel free. It's not, you're not obliged to. It's just if you feel like having a little fun, drop on by.
People are having a lot of fun over there. And I am working on a Photoshop of My Unfair Lady. So have fun with that.
Another 23-year-old child.
Yeah.
Who's in
got a trust fund.
Yeah, who loves libertarianism. Have you read Anne Rand?
Doesn't want his trust fund to have taxes on it. Yes.
Well, mind you, I'm mocking a much, much younger version of myself when I say this. You know,
well,
30 years ago.
Well, that's kind of good, though. I mean,
30 years ago, that was me. I was absolutely believed in.
No one's going to tell me what to do.
Well, I believed in the smartest and most capable people should run everything because I was the smartest and the most capable, and I was fastest and tallest and cleverest and quickest. But even in my darkest libertarian moments, my mom was broke after the divorce. We didn't have much of anything for a long time. And but she was working. And so the idea that we should just cut people like that loose was unacceptable. So there had to be a humane way of tempering markets to do to not just roll over people who were. And as I grew older, the list of people who I could put into the, oh, these people got screwed category, got longer and longer. Yeah. And the people who were winners in the free market got shorter and shorter. And I suddenly realized, oh, the whole game is rigged for the people at the top.
We are getting to the point, too, where people, everything is so marketed. Everything that you do, and I know I talked about this last week, the marketability of motherhood, that there is, the market puts no value on that. No. The market puts no value, really, on intelligence anymore or learning.
No, no.
People joke about, do you want fries with that BA in sociology? Uh-huh. But what is the value to our culture of having people know shit?
Well, there is a great value, and then we're sort of easing into our podcast about work, the world of work, but I think that's a good thing. There are jobs I can point to right now. I spoke to a friend of mine 2 days ago, down from Chicago, who I've known for years, who pointed out a sector of the economy that he works in where there are hundreds of jobs. And this is not manufacturing. That's usually my go-to place. But this was a different sector of the economy where there are hundreds of jobs occupied by people who are going to retire real soon. High-skill jobs require 18 months of training and so forth and have decent outcomes. You will go into that job making mid to upper five figures. So those
For a single person is a decent middle class living. $50,000 a year is not super, super rich, but it's not. You're making it.
You're making it.
And in the middle, in the Midwest, you are anyway.
And there's room to grow. It's, you know, there's room to grow in this kind of job. However, what they're looking for on this job are skill sets. They're not looking for people with a liberal arts education. They're not, because I draw a really strong distinction between being skilled and being smart. There are skill sets that are really valuable, but I have gotten in more trouble on a, on jobs by being smart. Because first,
you're a threat to your boss.
Well, yeah. First, they hire you as a project manager to fix a problem. And then you realize, oh, okay, I fixed this problem and this problem. And then here comes the third problem. Oh, the third problem is that guy over there. Fire that guy and your problem goes away.
Because he's the cousin of my boss.
He's the guy who's going to buy the software package that's going to nuke the company.
Yeah.
Here's the proof that the software package he's about to buy will nuke the company.
It doesn't matter.
Why isn't anyone stopping him?
Owns the software company.
Oh, no, he's sleeping with so-and-so. And his girlfriend, you know, after he dumped her, his girlfriend is such-and-so, and the company that's this is bribing him. Okay.
He's going to land with a golden parachute in the job with the software company that he just,
And if you work in a place where there's one or two of those people, and there are always one or two of those people.
But not all of them are evil. I mean, sometimes you do. I've said this before. Get the wife of somebody upstairs in the manager's office.
Who's really good.
You in customer service who's really knows what she's doing. You know,
I have, and I have nothing against using my position of power to help my relatives. At least Richard M. Daley was Richard J. Daley was honest about that. Most jobs are gotten by connections that you know somebody. I'm looking for a guy who can sling a wrench. Do you know somebody? Yeah, my cousin can do that. That kind of thing. So that's just normal human behavior. It's where you get into a job where you find out that there's this nest of people who have a lot of power, a lot of decision-making ability. They absorb an enormous amount of the budget, and they're fucking useless. And the reason they're useless is because they're an alderman's friend, or they're the boss's cousin, or they're somebody drinking buddy. And that is a disaster. Because if you're a project manager in that kind of organization, eventually some breadcrumbs from some project you have to fix, you have to fix this problem, it's going to lead you to them, and you're going to discover they're the problem. They're the ones taking the company down, and that is the one thing you're never allowed to say. And you get caught in this terrible position where you cannot fix the problem. Not only can you not fix the problem you've been hired to fix, you can't even speak about it.
Yeah.
And that's an awful place to be. And that's when intelligence becomes an absolute detriment, because it's clear that you understand that these clowns are the problem, and you understand that your boss is a fop or a fool or corrupt for keeping them on board. And such person as you cannot be allowed to continue to have these terrible thoughts.
Right.
And continue in the workplace. So we're going to find a way to get rid of you. It's a truism, but of course it's true that it's easier to get a job when you have a job, because right now it is nearly as hard as it was to find a job as it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 5 years ago. And a staggeringly large number of people, as we talked about last week, have just fallen out of the workforce, have just stopped looking, and therefore we don't count them anymore. Everyone who's listened to this podcast for more than a couple of weeks knows that most HR departments exist to keep people out.
That's right. And their job is to disqualify you and find a reason not to hire you.
Because hiring you is a risk, and not hiring you is not. Mm-hmm. So, and one of the filters that is now incredibly common, I mean, people are saying this, and it's not illegal. It's not a protected class, which we'll get to later, I assure you. But one of the things that is now essentially a disqualifier
is being unemployed.
Being unemployed.
Yeah.
If you don't have a job, we're not interested in talking to you, because we have 20 other people who we can talk to who aren't unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and so that's the world you live in.
I do want to point out a hat tip to Jamie at the blog Intoxination. USA Today came out with jobless claims. Now, these are jobless claims, mind you.
Right. Uh-huh.
But they really have gone down to the level, as Jamie put it. Obama finally got jobless claims down to the level of when Bush left office in May of 2007.
Yeah.
So jobless claims are down quite a bit. Yeah,
they are.
And private employment, not government employment, is up.
Well, I have read other websites and received other emails from other uncles of liberty, and they essentially are saying, yeah, but workforce participation, labor force participation is down, and that's why and so the politicians are lying to you.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, that's how unemployment has always been counted.
Yeah.
Secondly, I have seen many, 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 many Barack Obama speeches and administration speeches and so forth on the subject of employment. They're constantly talking about the people who have just quit looking.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that this is somehow some cooked number that they're hiding from you is bullshit. I agree that we should count unemployment in a radically different way, because the economy has changed. And the way the economy has changed, it doesn't account for people who've just lost hope and given up.
Yeah.
But I'm glad the number of people who are applying for jobless benefits is down.
Yeah.
It's still brutal, and it's still having this incredible warping effect on the economy as a whole. And it's having this weird, like, you know how superconducting fluids can flow past each other in opposite directions and never touch each other?
Mm-hmm.
We have these two economies now, where one, things are good, are great if you're at the top, or good and getting better if you're in the upper. And then there's, and for a lot of us, it's the depression. And it's been the depression for 7 years now, 6 years now. And it's, and we don't see much of an end in sight. And these two economies don't
touch. And that comes as no surprise at all to African Americans.
No,
so,
God, no.
You know, this is a totally different, Melissa Harris-Perry has talked about that, you know, that a 15% unemployment rate in the African American community, there would be dancing in the streets.
There'd be cause for celebration.
Yep.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yep.
So we have these multiple economies. There are definitely two economies. One of which you can point to and say things are getting better, and that is true. And one of which you can point to that things are bad, and they've been bad a long time. They're getting worse, and those people are always the subject of the beatings that the Republicans hand out to prove that, you know, all poor people need is another kick in the throat.
Right.
And
right.
Then they'll dust themselves off and get up and become productive members of society. And they always point to that other group, the people who are, you know, they point to me, essentially, who won't get off my lazy death. Yeah. OK.
We're going to talk about work today, because there's just been so much in the news lately that sort of dovetailed right into discussing workplace issues.
Yeah.
And so this is going to be a very topical podcast, but it also has a theme.
Yes.
And let's start this letter from Alex.
Yes.
That came in yesterday.
About Stephen Colbert.
It came in last night, and that's actually about Stephen Colbert. I'll read it. It's, hey, Driftglass, Andrew Sullivan is on the Colbert Report right now defending some bigot who lost his job for opposing same-sex marriage. He's arguing that the man shouldn't have had to lose his job as a result of a belief he sincerely holds. I couldn't help but yell at the television screen, "What about Alec Baldwin, you fucking hypocrite?"
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Andrew Sullivan believes that only liberals should lose their job for saying something bigoted. Okay, and I also thought that Andrew Sullivan, you know, was his voice was all frosting and,
yes.
Oh, I'm just so reasonable about everything. And
it is,
he's not.
No, he's not. It was quite amazing. It really, and I was not in any way surprised or disappointed in Andrew Sullivan. Andrew mm-hmm. Sullivan is a towering hypocrite mm-hmm. who does not debate people who disagree with him and who actually know what they're talking about. He doesn't do that. He doesn't put himself into an arena, by and large, where someone's going to call him out on his bullshit and follow up with him with difficult questions.
Can we back up for just a minute
sure.
and talk about Mozilla and Mr.
Yeah.
Ike, who was fired or let go or somehow removed from the payroll, is the word that's being used these days a lot, because he contributed $1,000 to the Prop 8 campaign.
Right. He took an active role by spending his money mm-hmm. on Prop 8 to keep gay people from being able to be married.
Right.
It's an act. It wasn't a matter of sort of saying I'd be less comfortable. I'm not comfortable. It's not a matter of expressing a preference verbally. He took an active role mm-hmm. in trying to prevent people from having basic civil rights.
That's what confused me, because I heard some pundit say, well, it's not like he ran up to somebody's door and told them what to do with their lives. And I thought, ran up to somebody's door and told them what to do with their lives. It's exactly like he ran to Loving versus Virginia, the Loving couple, and said, no, you're black. He's white. You can't get married because I'm uncomfortable with that. And I'm going to give money to make sure you two can't get married in the state of California or wherever.
Which he
is exactly the same. He has the right to do that, but don't pretend he's not telling people what they can do with their lives by passing this law.
And taking an active role in doing it. Again, perfectly free to do it.
Yep.
The person I was most disappointed with, but I shouldn't be because he's a comedian, mm-hmm. is Stephen Colbert.
For not calling Andrew Sullivan out on his hypocrisy?
Stephen Colbert has laced into George Bush. Mm-hmm. He has drubbed Bill Kristol while sitting in front of both of them. Andrew Sullivan, with his very high and pious notions about bigotry, and this is just stuff he was writing. He's been writing on his blog the last week or so. And, you know, we have not won this debate because we have constantly exposed others' hatreds or racked up the number of people we can condemn as homophobes. Of course, there's bigotry and ignorance out there, but calling everyone who disagrees with you a bigot rules out the chance of persuading them, drives them into a further defensive couch, and prevents us winning the argument in the long run. So calling people bigots is just counterproductive and wrong, and we shouldn't do it, says Andrew Sullivan on April 8th, 2014. Alec Baldwin is a homophobic bigot. Andrew Sullivan, headline of his blog.
Was that 10 years ago? No, it wasn't. It was 10 weeks ago.
November 13th.
Yeah.
November 14th. Okay. The next day, yes, Alec Baldwin is a homophobic bigot, says Andrew Sullivan on his blog. And not just a bigot, but a, quote, raging, violent bigot. Andrew Sullivan whipped up a mob, absolutely shredded MSNBC for hiring him in the first place. This indefensible hire of this homophobic monster. How dare you? How dare you? How dare you? Called out Rachel Maddow. Basically, if a conservative did this, you'd never let him get away with it. They would be out on their ear. You would never let this pass.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He and Anderson Cooper did a tag team on this. Can you believe this monstrous homophobic this beast? They did a whole special segment on Anderson Cooper on what a monstrous, awful person Alec Baldwin is for essentially calling a paparazzi a very mean thing, a very gay, slurry thing when the guy was stalking his kid. Again, it wasn't on the air. It wasn't on the job. He was on the street. A guy was stalking his kid, and he said something really mean to the guy. And it wasn't the first time. But Andrew Sullivan created a mob and created a mob atmosphere, kept pounding away at MSNBC for hiring this asshole in the first place, and then congratulated them when they fired him. And then now his excuse is, well, I never called for him to be fired. Yeah, you did. You did everything but. It's not only a matter of this pious bullshit that we shouldn't be calling people bigots. Well, that's what you did.
Mm-hmm.
That was your whole thing. It was Stephen Colbert's staff not bothering to Google anything to do with Alec Baldwin and Andrew Sullivan at all. Not bothering to find out. You know, Bill Kristol, the first question he asked him was, so how's that project for the New American Century coming along?
Yeah.
But Mr. Sullivan gets a pass because he gets a pass. So part one is this ludicrous notion that people should not be calling each other bigots when that is exactly what he was doing. Secondly, the idea that we shouldn't call for people to be fired just because their opinions differ from us.
Mm-hmm.
Except that's sort of what you did. And it sort of wasn't the first time you did it. And third is this fucking beltway privilege outrage over, oh my gosh, can you believe someone lost their job because their boss thought they were saying things that were mean?
Politics.
Oh my God.
Their job, you know.
How could, in America, if we let, and this is where it Connor Friedersdorf.
Yeah, talk about that.
Connor Friedersdorf of the Atlantic just cracked me up. He was just wringing his hands over the notion that if this is allowed to stand, that the powerful will have even more leverage than the powerless. If we permit people to be fired in this country because their boss doesn't like them, oh my God, who knows where that's going to end?
I wonder if we could ever get Shirley Sherrod to comment on that.
How many
liberals who are listening to this podcast right now keep their mouths shut at work and at church and in the grocery store and don't have a bumper sticker on their car because they live in a red state? And if they did, their husband would lose business. They would be attacked. They would have, you know, people not coming to their house at Halloween because those liberals, you know, it's crazy to think that people on the right don't persecute.
Oh,
and get people fired for their politics.
Yeah, Connor Friedersdorf said, whatever you think of gay marriage, the general practice of punishing people in business for bygone political donations is most likely to entrench powerful interests and weaken the ability of the powerless to challenge the status quo. If this attitude spreads, it will damage our society.
Well, I agree with him, but fuck you.
And I would suggest that you spend all of your hard-earned Atlantic money. This is the problem when you allow 12-year-olds who have never had a job in their fucking life, a real job outside of writing their opinions about shit they know nothing about, to talk about things they know nothing about. I don't know where to begin to describe how stupid this is. Mm. Yes, I agree with you. If you would like to have that argument, hop in the time machine, go back 30 years and take it up with Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
Take it. And I couldn't believe I had to do this. And then a whole bunch of people did this because it was one of those sort of Jim DeMint moments. And boy, we'll get to him in a minute. When you actually had to explain to people who have big salaries, magazine bylines, go on punting things, you know, like this Stephen Colbert show every now and then, who are actually solicited for their opinion and hold forth in declarative sentences about these things, what at-will employment means. And the fact that, yeah, pretty much you can get fired for any reason or no reason at all as long as you're not in one of these few protected categories. And even if you are, you have to affirmatively prove that was the reason, that you were fired because you're gay, because you were fired because you're a woman, not because you believe that to be true. You have to find, like, documentation that your boss plotted to fire you because you're gay or because you're a woman or because you're over 40. And if you can't do that, sorry, fuck you, you're out of a job. That is the norm in the rest of working America. That clearly isn't the norm in the crowd Andrew Sullivan hangs out with. It clearly isn't the norm at the Atlantic. But it astonishes me that these people who are holding forth on the horrors of being fired for having an opinion that's unpopular at work or having some aspect of yourself that your boss doesn't like being grounds for termination, people who are suddenly horrified by that when that's been going on for 30 fucking years.
Mm-hmm.
Every shoe clerk I know has gone through this. I've gone through this 4 or 5 times. I've been at places where they fired all the women.
Yep.
They sacked all the minorities.
Yep.
They sacked people for being smart, for having an opinion, for mentioning things. The idea that I would have mentioned I was a blogger at my last full-time job, 2 phone calls I would have been fired. And those 2 phone calls, I guarantee you, would have been made.
Yep.
Now, I agree with the general principle that people shouldn't be fired for those reasons. But that's what happens in a free, unregulated labor market that every conservative and libertarian I've ever heard of wants us to have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you don't like the idea of a boss being able to screw you because he doesn't like the way you part your hair or doesn't like your political opinion or just would rather not have someone around who's that tall or that smart or whatever the reason is. Take it up with capitalists. Take it up with
Rand Paul. Right to work states. Yes.
And that was what was so astonishing. It wasn't merely that Andrew Sullivan is a complete fucking hypocrite. And just in a sense, that's what makes him the most conservative of all, is he just disavows shit he wrote yesterday when it becomes inconvenient. And that really is a classic conservative characteristic. It's, oh, I said that 2 months ago. Fuck that. That doesn't count. Or, no, I'm going to parse what I said in such a way that it doesn't seem to contradict what I just said, even though it clearly does.
Yeah.
And of course, no one's there to hold him accountable. The only person who is there who actually has a face-to-face with him was Stephen Colbert. And all Stephen Colbert did was let him talk, shake his hand, and wish him well. And that is reeks of privilege.
And
so shut
up, Andrew. Speaking of privilege, I want to mention an article I read this week by Allison Kilkenny, who is a podcaster at Citizen Radio. I'm sure our listeners have heard of it. She wrote a really good article about Alec Baldwin and Piers Morgan.
Yeah.
And looking at it from a different perspective of, you know, both of these white men can say, I give up, I'm walking away, or I'm, you know, my show's been canceled, but I'm leaving on my own terms and so forth. Why should I beg for forgiveness for something I didn't do? You know?
Exactly.
And saying, you know, this is, you're able to do this if you can go to your house in Malibu.
Yeah.
And know that your groceries are taken care of for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me, the title of this article is I Give Up, the Battle Cry of the Privileged.
Yep.
It's really important to take that down a notch and recognize that all of us who say that, who, you know, it's fine to take a break from politics if you need to, absolutely,
sure,
as we talked about last week, but to wash your hands of it and say, oh, you know, so-and-so has, Alec has won.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to fight anymore because Alec has won and I'm just disgusted with the political scene and I'm walking away. That's the bad cry of the privileged. You know, if you can do that,
because there are millions
the rest
of people...
of us have to wait, have to fight for this, because there's a lot of people who are incapable of doing
exactly. There are millions of people who don't get to quit.
Yep.
They're stuck with the perpetual bad boss. They're stuck in a perpetual low-wage job.
They're looking for reproductive rights in East Texas, and they don't get to quit. You know, that problem is going to continue to exist, and we have to fight for them.
Can I read you this? This had to do with a post I did with regarding David Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
But the response I got, a comment response I got, was almost exactly my own life story. And it's real quick, but I think it buttons this up really nicely, and then we can move on to the next thing. It was by Habitat Vic, who comments a lot.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
And Habitat, and this is a comment, so I'm going to read it verbatim. When I was a young buck in high tech in the 80s, and that was yours truly as well. Yes, I had a reputation of telling it like it was. Hell, even landed a punch on one of my managers. Long story, I survived. He was transferred and left the company.
Yeah.
That said, even then as a cocky 20-something salesman, I knew you had to have landing options, other jobs, parenthetically, and a decent fuck you fund at the ready before speaking out.
Mm-hmm.
30 years hence, I have neither the money in the bank and certainly not the job options, parenthetically, as a 50-something, to do as David Brooks advises. Sadly, I've become Jack Lemmon, the Shelley character in Glengarry Glen Ross.
Mm-hmm.
You know, David Brooks advised, you know, employers should hire rebel truth tellers.
Risk takers.
Risk takers. People who will tell it like it is. People who are not afraid to, you know, in the alternate universe in which you and Connor Friedersdorf and Andrew Sullivan live, that's a great place. That's a great, because I'm sure in your little pundit circle jerk, that's true, except, of course, nobody ever tells you that you're a liar to your face. So I guess that doesn't happen on your job. But for the rest of us, being a hellraiser and a risk taker on the job means you are unemployed the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And so advising people to do that who are over a certain age or have no money, have no fallback position, who have no hammock, who have no fuck you fund in the bank, unlike Alec Baldwin or Piers Morgan, is ludicrous. And it does. It reeks of privilege. Because you know that if Andrew Sullivan's blog burns to the ground tomorrow, he'll blow in a call to Tina Brown, and he'll have a job the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Or he'll write another book, and that'll be published, because he always gets his book published. If David Brooks loses New York Times job, he'll get a job teaching at Yale, or he'll get a job writing for the Washington Post, or he'll get a job on a speaker's tour. These people will...
Drew Class.
Yep.
We're going to change now.
We're
going to change gear and talk about gender.
Okay, fine. Says the chick. All right, fine. I know. I'm getting off my soapbox.
Well, you don't have to get off your soapbox. I want to talk about gender disparity because we had the Equal Pay Day this week.
Ah, yes, we did.
Cokie Roberts didn't notice that there's gender disparity on the Sunday show.
Yeah. Sorry, Blue Gal. That isn't changing the topic. That's beltway privilege.
Yep.
That's defending the establishment at all costs by
what? The car always shows up right on time to get me on the show.
Yeah, what?
So what's the problem?
And Peggy Noonan sees three of everything, so, you know, it really is. It just is.
And I want to talk about this guy, this congressman, the kissing congressman.
Yeah.
Who, you know, on the security tape has his shirt hanging out and is kissing this married woman who's, by the way, they were primo fundraisers for this guy. This is Senator Ensign all over again.
When you told me this story, I thought
this has happened
eerily.
Before.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is. It's, you know, they're good friends and they fundraised for him and helped get him elected. And he ran on family values platform in Louisiana.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It's,
Remember David Vitter? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this guy announces that he's seeking reelection and lets the woman go off of his staff on the same day.
Yeah.
And I'm sure looks in the mirror and says, I'm not perfect. I'm just forgiven.
I'm sure the Lord will forgive me as an imperfect man. Yeah. And I'm sure the inbred Hicks who elected you in the first place will reelect you.
Yeah.
Because let's face it.
You've got an R after your name. So that means your family values.
And you're them.
Yeah.
But he does represent their values.
He does. Yeah.
White male privilege is their value.
The lady did tempt me and I did eat.
Yeah.
It's in the Bible.
That bitch tempted me.
Yeah. And she's gone now. So I won't be tempted no more. 5 reasons to quit your job from the ladder. That great line from Bridget Jones' Diary.
Uh-huh.
Why did you leave your last job? I was shagging my boss.
Yeah.
And then during the interview, he says, at this department, you are never fired for shagging the boss.
Oh, yeah. Now, show of hands. I can't see your hands, but show of hands of people who have worked in a workplace where at least 2 people did not get promoted or hired because they were fucking somebody.
I don't know. I definitely know people who wound up marrying their secretary after a divorce or marrying their coworker. And it was pretty clear that something that had been going on, you know, outside the view of the security cameras long before that. I've seen that happen twice.
And I've seen it happen many times. And it crosses gender lines. I will say that.
Yeah.
But it's a privilege of power. And you can't, in a place where someone above you controls your economic future, your economic destiny, power, that's a true power relationship. Mm-hmm. And that relationship is always subject to abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that you're going to pick out one example of one CEO who basically got fired, he's the face of the company for doing something the company didn't want him to do. And that's your example of abuse of power in the workplace is, again, such it reeks so much of cluelessness, of privilege, of why the fuck are you considered a public intellectual that I got to laugh and I have to change the subject.
Well, we're going to change the subject again because I want to talk about a different side of this. I want to talk about the BCDC that we talked about yesterday at lunch.
Yeah.
This is the Baltimore City Detention Center.
Yeah.
There's a fantastic article by Jeffrey Toobin in The New Yorker this week. It's the New Yorker with the cover of Barack Obama feeding medicine to all the Republicans as little kids. Very funny. The Baltimore City Detention Center is a big, huge jail where most of the people that are there are awaiting trial. They're not sentenced. And the FBI has been investigating this detention center how can I put this, being run by a gang leader in the prison.
Yeah.
That the prison has a inmate named Tavon White.
Uh-huh.
Tavon was caught on an FBI wiretap talking on his cell phone in the jail cell.
Uh-huh.
And by the way, while he was in prison, or while he was being held, awaiting trial, excuse me, I want to be fair here.
Yeah.
While he was awaiting trial at the Baltimore City Detention Center, he was able to purchase via cell phone a BMW and a Mercedes, I believe, was the other one. Yeah, Mercedes-Benz and a BMW while he was an inmate at the Baltimore City Detention Center.
Which cracks me up because...
And he was caught, but... Oh, I'm sorry.
How do you drive your Mercedes?
He was caught on an FBI wiretap saying, "This is my jail. You understand this. I'm dead serious. I make every final call in this jail. Everything come to me." And he uses a lot of swear words that I'm not going to use, including N-words and so forth. But he's basically, if anyone wants to stab anybody, if anyone wants to punch anybody, if anyone wants to do anything in this jail, they have to come to me first and get permission. Uh-huh. Now, that's the part of it that, you know, okay, this gang member clearly was running things among the inmates, right?
Right.
Employment-wise, 3/4 of the guards in this jail are women. And it turned out that they had been hiring extremely young women, 20 to 23 African American women, I'm sure as part of equal opportunity. And I would never be one to say that an African American woman can't do this job. That's not my point.
I would also imagine there's some cost savings involved in
hiring someone
who's
Inexperienced, who's starting out, right, entry level. This is supposedly entry level. Many of these guards are now facing charges from the FBI with having smuggled cell phones, drugs, all kinds of contraband into the facility. The guards were subject to cursory or non-existent searches when they entered the premises. They brought in the cell phones for the inmates to use, although they were forbidden from carrying phones while at work. And then Tavon White, this gang leader who ran the prison, supposedly, fathered 5 children by 4 guards. One of the guards had his name tattooed on her wrist. Huh. Another had his name tattooed on her neck. A fellow gang member named Jamar Anderson was involved with 5 guards. And it comes down to some of the choices that were made in hiring, not to screen, not to search, not to... to simply say we can have inexperienced entry-level people from the same neighborhoods where these gang members live. So there may be a relationship of some kind anyway, you know, with knowing one another. And not screening at all in employment for this really horrible job of this ugly, ugly, awful pit of a prison in Baltimore.
Yep.
Where nobody wants to work anyway. You know, no experienced person who could find a job someplace else would want to work there. I mean, it's deeply, deeply sad to read the stories of some of these guards. You know, well, yeah, my boyfriend's in jail, but so's my dad.
Exactly.
You know, and you realize this woman has no vision for her life whatsoever of being with anyone who's not in prison, because that's the men in her life are in jail. So that's that. That they talked about that this happened in the 90s. Uh-huh. They started hiring these young women in large numbers. But it is a hiring decision. And the problem is, and again, I would never say, oh, don't hire young black women to do this job. They can't.
No,
that's not what I'm saying at all. Everybody who works in a jail where you have contact with inmates needs to be screened in some way.
Yes.
To make sure that they can do that job without getting...
Well, and mentored and supervised.
And mentored and supervised and searched if necessary. You know, if you're not allowed to have a phone at work, how come you've got 6 phones in your underpants?
Yeah. Well, you know, and juxtapose this with Charlie Pierce was writing... I'm doing this from memory, so I'm going to get a couple of facts wrong. But Charlie Pierce reprinted a story of a journalist friend of his who got laid off and fell into the... lower class, fell into poverty. You know, believe me, I understand the arc of that career, and ended up in retail, in shitty retail, at a sporting goods store whose name he will not mention. But as a writer, he could write about his experience in a way that was extremely riveting and readable. And he said, this guy just said, look, the world in which I now live is humiliating.
Yeah.
I am a grown man. And I'm not allowed to sit on the job. Even if there's no one in the store, standing is you're supposed to walk and stand all the time. You're not allowed to sit, which is hard on his back and his knees, I'm sure. Secondly, he's searched. He's frisked every time he leaves the store. And every time he comes back in, he's patted down because corporate policy is. And it's like, dude, really? I'm going across the way to get, you know, a Red Bull. Doesn't matter. That's policy, you know. And he gets patted down by Chip, who is, you know, 22. And the idea that the security protocol at a sporting goods store is tighter than the Baltimore jail, that they're more careful about what enters and exits a place that sells you shoes than a place that holds drug kingpins or drug dealers is a function of privilege and money. And this is, if I may risk offending lots of people, and I don't mean to do this, the overlap between the Baltimore prison story, the Baltimore jail story, and Game of Thrones and The Walking Dead.
Okay. You're offending all the Walking Dead fans.
I'm offending everybody. These are narratives about lawless places where there is no hierarchy. There is no justice or law or order outside of power and money. That's it. And tribal affiliation. There's absolutely no structure at all but survival of the fittest. And you create these, in two cases fictional, one case tragically factual, Lord of the Flies situation. And guess who goes to the top? The most powerful, the most ruthless, and the most cunning, the most willing to exploit. And I have no doubt that if we took Tywin Lannister out of Game of Thrones and put him in the middle of The Walking Dead, he'd do fine. He'd end up running the country because he knows how power works. But the idea that in a place where there is no law and order, everything shakes out around who has power, who has leverage, who can threaten you, who can make your life better, who you get intimately involved with, and who you affiliate with, period. And there's nothing else. Yep. Is how human beings act when we are not in a place that has some sort of governing structure.
Yep. And just to get back to this New Yorker article, which I do recommend to everyone, one of the things about workplace that this article brings out is that when a guard has sex with an inmate, the supposition is always that the guard is at fault because the inmate can't go anywhere. Two things that are very interesting about that. One is it's very clear from this article that the inmates were in complete control of the situation.
Absolutely.
They gave money to the guards who were making nothing at this job.
Money.
They had way more money. The inmates had way more money than the guards and were paying the guards and paying the guards rent. And you're my baby mama and here's the rent this month. You know, and the hostile work environment that these guards were thrown into. And then they were picked because they had low self-esteem and, you know, they were picked by the jail to work there for that reason. And then they're picked by the drug lord as you're going to be my girlfriend for exactly the same reason they were hired as a guard in the jail.
Yeah.
And it's a very hostile work environment for these young girls.
Yes, absolutely.
To be in and be completely unprepared for.
And no one's there protecting them. No one is there showing them.
And the only thing that protects you is doing what you're told by the drug kingpin. Yeah.
So it's basically the Koch brothers in a very small. It is. If you have if you have more money than everyone else and can spend it any way you like and want to spend it to make.
You can buy a BMW for your girlfriend while you're in jail.
Yeah. Yes. You run the place.
Yeah.
And there's no countervailing force that stops that from happening.
Yeah.
And I would like, if you don't mind.
No, go right ahead.
To step over to Jim DeMint.
Yes, let's step over to Jim DeMint's history lesson.
Because once you start fetishizing the idea that government is always bad. Which is exactly what Republicans do. It's not a matter of, you know, what should government do? What's the proper role of government? People who say big government, I just want to slap them because there's nothing behind that. Okay, exactly how big should it be? Should it be 40 by 40? Should it be $1 trillion? What exactly should the size and scope of government be?
Completely artificial, made-up term that means nothing.
It means it's a way of hiding. I don't want any government. I don't want anybody telling me anything. I want to be able to do whatever the hell I want, when I want, except I'd like Social Security and Medicare when I get sick and when I need money. But those are mine. I'm not a moocher. I'm not a moocher. Those are mine. So you have this creepy fetishization of anti-government policy, of just government is always bad, and the individual acting alone is always how great things happen. And it becomes such a fetish. It becomes such a cult. It has become the Republican Party. That is conservatism now. That is the Republican Party now. But it becomes such a cult that they must now reverse engineer all of history into their cult. Therefore, everything good that happened in history must have happened because of an individual and not because of big government. Because if there were any examples in history of big government doing anything good, they'd look like idiots, wouldn't they?
Mm-hmm.
So Jim DeMint, and so you start building this completely fake history out of nothing other than your little tracts, your little bumper stickers about how things should be. And then you end up with a former U.S. Senator, Jim DeMint, who's now making $1 million a year running the awful Heritage Foundation,
who
went from being, again, a member of the world's greatest deliberative body to running one of the most famous conservative think tanks in America, explained that slaves were not freed in the Civil War due to big government. He said, well, the reasons the slaves were eventually freed was the Constitution. It was like the conscience of the American people. Unfortunately, there were some court decisions like Dred Scott and others that defined some people as property. But the Constitution kept calling us back to all men are created equal. And we have inalienable rights in the minds of God. But a lot of the move to free slaves came from the people. It did not come from the federal government.
Yeah.
It came from a growing movement among the people, particularly people of faith, that this was wrong. People like Wilberforce, who persisted for years because of his faith and because of his love for people. So no liberal is going to win a debate that big government freed the slaves. In fact, it was Abraham Lincoln, the very first Republican, who took this on as a cause, and a lot of it was based on a love in his heart that comes from God. I don't know where to begin.
Yep.
I will say that I will repeat what I've said on previous occasions. The only thing that has ever changed the conservative mind is a million Union bayonets.
Yeah.
The idea that big government had nothing to do with freeing slavery, when all the right does is fetishize the Confederate flag and the noble struggle and the mm-hmm. War of Northern Aggression, mm-hmm. and they're just constantly desperately trying to rewrite the Civil War so that it wasn't about slavery. And Republicans, who were at the time abolitionists, aren't today's liberal Democrats.
Yeah.
They want it to be Lincoln and then Reagan and then them. And this straight line from, and there was never any big government involved. The Eisenhower never federalized National Guard troops to force states to integrate their schools.
Yes, they did.
The Supreme Court never forced people to allow interracial marriage to be legal.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why it is impossible to debate these people.
Yep.
'Cause this occurred to me the other day. It's actually worse than it was in the Civil War in one way. In the Civil War, you had two ideological systems butting heads. Coherent ideological systems. One was slavery is bad.
Yep.
And one was slavery is an institution created by God, sanctioned by God. God wants it this way. God wants white men to rule over all nations and tell everybody what to do. And therefore, it is a noble and Christian thing to do to enslave black people. Period. They really believed it.
Yep, they really
it's in all their
it.
Fucking documents. It's in the most famous speeches of the era. God was always invoked defending slavery. It was also a tremendous economic importance, so it doesn't hurt that, you know, this is the way they made money.
Right.
But it was this creepy combination of economics and religion.
Mm-hmm.
Today, there's no coherent ideological anything on the right. They just make shit up.
Yeah.
In the moment to confound and confuse and shut an argument down. You can't debate Jim DeMint because Jim DeMint is not functionally human anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He is a moron. He's a sock puppet who will say any crazy ass thing that pops into his head, but blah, 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 big government, blah, 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 bad.
And well, because he's paid very well to do that. And that's obviously his moral compass says, say what needs to be said to get paid.
Yeah. And there is no, but there's no, there's no system of thought behind him.
Yeah.
Other than Barack Obama is a usurping Kenyan monster who wants to kill your grandma and make your kids gay.
Yep.
There's
yep.
nothing to argue against because these aren't people in a true citizen sense anymore. These are animals reacting as a herd to their brainwashed masters on Fox News who tell them what to think,
mm-hmm.
who rattle them up when you need them to vote, who turn them loose. And it's like arguing with swine or kittens. It doesn't, you know, these are great neighbors, lovely people, awesome friends, wonderful, wonderful people you can call on when you have a flat tire. People I'm sure I'd like to have a beer with and talk about sports. When it comes to talking about politics, the sheer unbreakable, adamantine persistence of their ignorance they're willful. They're grinning, happy stupidity when it comes to this is indestructible.
Yeah.
And so when you get to that core where they just make shit up, and then you bounce that up to the level of the media who just shrugs and says, well, you know, both sides.
Yeah.
Well, you know, liberals probably do it too. Jonathan Chait's doing that this week. Joan Walsh is having a fit because Jonathan Chait has written a long article about how, yeah, Republicans are hate mongers and they do depend on this and they do race baiting, but liberals are pretty bad too. Well, why? Well, they keep bringing it up.
Yeah.
And that's unfair. So, you know, really both sides. And that's where I think you have to start thinking about the fact that you're never, again, I've said it a million times, you're never going to reason with these people. Yeah. You're never going to, you cannot convince Jim DeMint or anyone who thinks Jim DeMint has anything to say. You're never going to convince Lou Gohmert. You're never going to convince Rand Paul. You're never going to convince Marco Rubio of anything. So then what?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Let's do a quick correction.
Yes.
We had a correction on, and we knew when you were talking that you were going to have a correction on the inflation numbers.
Yes.
And someone wrote in to us, and thank you very much, about inflation being based on rental values that are estimated for the housing market.
Steve wrote in and said the housing cost value in CPI is based on rental price, not home price.
Yeah. And and they assume what your house, if you're an owner, what your house would rent for.
Yeah.
So that makes sense.
It makes much more sense.
Yeah.
Because if it were based on straight housing prices, it would be so much worse now.
Game of Thrones. Steve. Let's talk for a minute about Game of Thrones.
Okay.
Game of Thrones. The opening credits change. There's new places in the opening credits. It's a bigger world.
They racked back further and we can see more of the world.
The young Stark girl gets her needle back.
She does.
I hope everyone's watched it by now.
Yeah. Well, if you haven't, it's It is a much bigger world now.
Yeah.
I'll go back to the brackets they had for the greatest television show in the Golden Age. Esquire did like brackets and Breaking Bad season 5 won. I would agree with that.
I would agree with that also.
But I think Game of Thrones is doing very well. It is doing for its viewers what I've gotten spoiled now. Really good television shows do, which is stay true to its story and undercut your expectations about what heroes are and what villains are and what behavior gets rewarded and what behavior you should look down your nose at. And it changes. It lets people change. It lets characters grow. Star Trek had the same, you know, handful of characters for years. They never changed. They never grew. They never altered their basic character outline. That was the reassuring part of Star Trek. That was the reassuring part of Bonanza.
Yep.
Same guys. You're going to go back to the Ponderosa at the end of the episode who rode out from the Ponderosa at the beginning. These episodic novels are more than willing to kill off their own main characters.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And if they did it gratuitously, I would say that's a terrible and cruel thing to do. But they're not doing it gratuitously. I really do think they are sending a clear message about who the author thinks real heroes are, and they are prostitutes and dwarfs and cripples and outcasts and bastards. Those are the people who are going to save your life in the end. Those are the people who are going to rise and do amazing things. And it's also a really great study in sort of obliviousness, because it's a little bit like Walking Dead. Most of the action takes place in a small area, and all of these people in this small, relatively prosperous area are all very concerned about their own little individual concerns about political fighting and power and stabbing each other in the back and who's going to marry who and the king's a sadist. And it's a screwed up court system based on a chivalry and hospitality and dynamic that is dying.
Mm-hmm.
After the Red Wedding, the whole idea of hospitality is now dead.
Yep.
The idea that you can't do certain things is dead. That was the equivalent of dressing up as cops and shooting people at the St. Valentine's Day massacre.
Yeah.
You transgressed the most basic laws of what keeps the civilization going. And now the civilization is going to fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
But as they are focusing on their own little problems, nobody's noticing that there's a fucking army of zombies and wildlings coming in from the north.
Yeah.
And from the south, there's a gigantic army of dragons and unsullied. And nobody's paying any attention to what the real problems are.
Yeah.
And the author is telling you this is coming.
Mm-hmm. He tells you at the very beginning this is coming.
Winter is coming. Winter is coming. Yeah. And I still think that racking out further and further at each season is going to reveal more about the solar system that they live in. But I can't be sure about that. Maybe winter is a moon.
Ooh.
Maybe winter is like with Nightfall, the Isaac.
I think you're giving too much credit.
Really?
I don't think it's going to be that poetic. No, I think winter is.
I think winter's downfall.
Winter, yeah.
But there's a parallel here with Nightfall, Isaac Asimov Nightfall, which is what happens once every 2,000 years when the sun is eclipsed, and night falls over the whole planet for like 8 hours.
Oh yeah.
So. Some great seasonal change is coming that's precipitated by, I have the assurance of someone who knows the author that this is not a science fiction story.
Mm-hmm.
This is not, you know, planetary alignments and shit, but.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that it's fire and ice. The dragons and the White Walkers are going to fight.
Mm-hmm.
That's.
But they're, everyone you know up until now pretty much is not in those two camps.
Yeah, that's right.
They're the ones in the middle who are vainly pursuing their own individual
power struggles,
interplays, mm-hmm. ignoring completely the fact that the entire world is about to come crashing mm-hmm. in on them, and they are mm-hmm. not prepared for it. They've let the wall rot. They've let. Mm.
I wonder where the lesson is for us on that, Driftglass.
Yeah.
Climate's not changing.
No, letting bad ideas back out of the box.
Yeah.
The whole system was set up with a wall and armies mm-hmm. and rules and stuff so that these bad things wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. And then eventually we stopped sorting paying the maintenance on that. We stopped mm-hmm. rebuilding our bridges and rebuilding our roads because, you know, who has to do that? That's really not important. And then eventually you need all those things and they're not there.
Yep.
They've been mothballed. And you have to drill your army with wooden guns because nobody thought you'd ever need guns again.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, the sword is now two swords. The House Lannister, or the House of Stark, has been melted down.
Yep.
And redistributed.
Mm-hmm. It's sad days for the Stark family, but you know yeah. they might rise again.
They might.
We have to see.
They might. This is not exactly the entire recap that we were planning on doing last week, but it sort of just got started.
It did, and you know what? Mm. I'm looking forward to some of the people dying.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are certain people I'd like to see die. No one better kill Tyrion.
No.
Everybody knows that. Okay.
Although I got to say, your take on the next season of True Detective was hilarious.
Thank you.
Yeah. If you haven't seen it, go over to Blue Gal's blog.
Go to Blue Gal's blog and look at who I put in True Detective. All right. We'll leave it at that. I'd like to end today with a letter from Beth that arrived at my Facebook page. And she writes, every Friday when I listen to your podcast, I start composing a thank you message in my head and never seem to get around to sending it. Join the club, Beth. My thank you notes are long overdue. Mm-hmm. So this will be quick and to the point. Thank you both so much for your calming and well-reasoned presence. I was ready to don sackcloth and ashes. That's a thing, right, Bible bitch?
Over the
McCutcheon ruling. And you and Driftglass talked me down. This happens again and again. You both give me hope and peace of mind when I despair over the state of my country. And we want our podcast listeners to know that you give us hope as well. So it's definitely mutual. I really, really appreciate the really important work that you do. More later, but I wanted to finally say something in appreciation. Hugs. Thank you, Beth. We really appreciate you right back.
Thank you, Beth.
Each week, we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Chloe. Chloe is a wonderful pet who soothes the two boys to sleep every night and greets the person that sent it when I arrive home from my nursing job in the wee hours each night. Therefore, all of us are required to look past her Hitler mustache, which is a mere accident of coloring. Yes.
Sure. That's what they all say.
She's a wonderful pet, and we will definitely look past. We have to look past the mustaches of our mothers very often, so that's just fine. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, or you can also write to both of us. We love hearing from you. Please be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service, Go Postal Unions, letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. All right, Driftglass.
Yeah.
How are the internet kitties doing this week?
Well, the internet kitties want you to know that if they really wanted to hack your OKCupid account, they'd have done it already.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the popping and the loving, lovey dovin. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2014, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
So we have another audio Science Fiction University from Dogfaced Herman. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dogfaced Herman.
And he says, some of my free time is spent volunteering at a farm. So when I'm mucking stalls or shoveling snow, I'm thinking about science fiction clips.
Ah, good for you.
Yeah. So here are six clips. Some of them are from TV, some from movies, some from interviews, etc. And there's, in this particular one, the first one, there is a missing name. And you have to tell me what the name is. And I'll give you half a bonus point for knowing what it is. But I think you'll know right away.
Okay.
Let's listen.
Why do you hate them? The Bene Gesserits?
I don't hate them. I don't trust them. I trust logic and statistics, not mysticism and prophecy.
That's from Dune.
Mm-hmm.
And the missing word is Mentat.
Mentat. Very good. Wow, you're good. All right.
The class of creature that a person that had to be evolved once machines were basically outlawed in the future.
Number two, Who is singing and what are they singing or whom are they singing about?
Turned on my television to Lucky Channel 13. Tuned in, Mr. He sure was on the beam.
With his predictions, with his convictions
of what the future will be.
That would be Mae West.
Oh, my goodness. How'd you know that?
Well, who else could it be?
Yeah, that's true.
Come on. Maybe Toadie Fields. I don't know. No, it's Mae West, and she's singing about Criswell.
Yes, she is singing about Criswell. Criswell predicts.
Yeah, and that I know that because of lots of reasons, but mostly because of Ed Wood.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All right. The next one, number three, these are some rules. And what are they rules for?
Women are still worth 10 points more than men in all age brackets, but teenagers now rack up 40 points, and toddlers under 12 now rate a big 70 points. The big score, anyone, any sex, over 75 years old, has been upped to 100 points. As always, how fast you move determines how long you live.
That would be Death Race 2000.
Very good.
I think starring David Carradine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure about that. Mm-hmm. I think it's starring David Carradine. Not the remake, the original.
No, the original from the 70s. Yeah. All right. Can you identify this one? It's on television.
I'm picking up four unidentified heat sources on my monitor screen.
Now they're probably just creatures, Baltar. Space creatures.
They just violated our airspace.
Bring me my monocle. I want to look rich.
No, I can't. I would get the snarkiness leads me in the direction of MST3K, but that's not it. Or in Dark Star, John Carpenter's Dark Star. That's
it's the same kind of zeitgeist that those shows have, but it's Space Ghost.
Oh, all right. Okay.
All right. Now you're going to recognize this one right away. I'll just tell you, it's Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yeah.
What element are they talking about?
We better send that stuff to the assay office in Durango.
And a few days later at the assay office, the chief assayer, Dr. Sebastian Flegel, held a press conference.
Gentlemen, in this heavy chest we have the world's first anti-gravity metal. Down, boy. Scientists call it a phosphoric butyl esahedron of axiom disulfide. We call it...
Now let's have a look at it, Doc.
Impossible, gentlemen.
Not even to get your picture in a paper.
Well, all right. But you have to be awfully quick.
And as the doctor opened the heavy lid, the world's entire available supply of... fell up and out of the chest, crashed through the ceiling, and disappeared into space.
Would you like me to say cheese?
Oh, they're talking about upsidazium.
Upsidazium.
Yeah.
Not unobtainium.
Not unobtainium.
That's a great show. That's such a great show.
Yeah.
Okay. And finally, here's an interview. Who is speaking and about what?
And they had elected a fellow by the name of Zemu, could be spelled X-E-M-U, to the Supreme Ruler. And they were about to unelect him. He, of course, had several key birds who were close to him. He was a suppressive, the end all suppressives. He got these administrators and so on and heads of planets in various positions and places. He picked off all the cowboys in the white hat and he got rid of them first.
Oh, that's, if it's Xenu, it's L. Ron Hubbard talking about Scientology.
Yep. And Dogface Herman says, Scientology, I don't understand the appeal. Could Bible Bitch please explain this for me? Sure.
Sure. Diuretics.
Diuretics.
No, that's Repo Man. That's, sorry.
L. Ron Hubbard invented this religion.
He did.
Kind of on a dare, we think.
But prompted by some of his science fiction friends and helped along by some of his fellow science fiction authors. By the way, I have entered once or twice many years ago in the L. Ron Hubbard Writers of Tomorrow contest.
Have you really?
Yeah, lost spectacularly both times. I was assured that it is in no way affiliated with the church, but, you know, I never suspect politics. I suspect most writers are rejected 99 times out of 100.
Mm-hmm.
So, but just as a matter of pure disclosure, I was rejected by the L. Ronners. And I think part of it is I'm stepping in Bible Bitch territory, but part of it is that it works. I mean, the entry point for the religion, for lots of religions, is helping someone ease their immediate suffering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Helping someone who's hungry or homeless or whatever get a meal or a roof over their head or whatever. And that's when you hit them up with the scripture. Hopefully you don't beat them over the head with it. The decent Christian, in my opinion, informs by example,
yep,
and doesn't proselytize. But Scientology at the very low end is basically using a lie detector, a very crude lie detector, to isolate things that are bothering you and helping you get over them.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
You know, psychology 101.
Yeah.
And you go in and talk to these very nice people who are very enthusiastic and very energetic and very glad to see you and really want to help you. And they, on a very basic level, they do. They do what you do if, you know, you go see a shrink. Once you have overcome a feeling, a real problem, they explain to you that it's part of this larger package that you can enjoy. And
yeah.
you can,
yeah.
you know, enjoy all these benefits now and after you die. And that's, it works, you know, it's again, it's real basic stuff. Go read A Stranger in a Strange Land. The Fosterites are basically the L. Ronners.
Yeah.
And Valentine Michael Smith, the protagonist of the story, breaks down how this works, how you set up a religion like a lodge system, like a Masonic lodge. You have various circles and you ascend higher and higher and higher. And each one of them has their purpose. So at the very widest point where you're casting your nets as wide as you can, you meet people's basic need for companionship,
mm-hmm.
Relief of suffering,
yep.
hunger, thirst, shelter, and community. And that's a good thing. Churches should do those things. You know, governments should do those things. So, but that's why it works. And it's got the word science in it. So
it's got the word science in it.
Gotta love that.
So that, you know, makes everything.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get started with the podcast.
The proper podcast. Yes.
First of all, so thank you, Dogface Herman. He says he's got about 30 more clips to share. So we will ask him. If he's listening right now, go ahead and send those over. We'd love to have them. People really do. The feedback on this has been great. So,
yeah.
And we'll go from there.